Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Romesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
You're listening to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, massive wins at the bottom of the Premier League table for Everton and Nottingham Forest. Will it be enough to keep them up? Leicester City and Southampton are beaten. Are they on their way to the Championship? We'll discuss both of those and big games at the top as well, as Arsenal clawed Manchester City's lead back to 1 point with victory at Newcastle United. We'll also ask what's going wrong for Manchester United. And also, Gregor Robertson joins us after completing the 92 grounds of the English Football League. This is The Game. Hello again and welcome back to The Game Podcast. Hope everyone had an enjoyable coronation weekend. Less said about it, the better. Let's talk about the football. Everton scintillating on the counter-attack. They got a huge victory this weekend to stun Brighton in the Premier League. I'm Hugh Wisencroft, by the way, alongside Tom Clark and Alison Rudd on The Game this Monday morning. So excited about Everton's win that I skipped over that. But there you go, 5-1 in the end. And it moves Everton out of the relegation zone. They now sit 17th and they leapfrog Leeds and Leicester City, who we'll come to a little bit later on. Sean Dyche said it showed that there is still life in the team. I think the victory for Everton and the manner of it was a huge boost and a message to everyone that they are not done, particularly the teams around them. And I think the psychological aspect out of this game was huge. It wasn't just beating Brighton away. It wasn't a 1-0 by the skin of your teeth. It was a team that really showed something. And if they can show that level, even close to that level again, they will pick up more results, and more results will obviously mean survival.
They Everton look, if you dropped in from Venus and you didn't know who was who in the league, you would think Everton were fighting for the title. You'd think, wow, they're streetwise. They've got everything, haven't they? They've got pragmatism, pace, imagination, a sort of brutality about them, ability to take advantage of your opponent's weaknesses. I actually think they got lucky that that's probably the worst first half Brighton have had. But the way they took advantage of it is the way that champions elect take advantage of stuff. It was so bizarre. Unbelievable match. Absolutely unbelievable. And yes, second half, Brighton woke up, four changes were made, and they did what they did against Fulham at home not so long ago, where they peppered the goal and just couldn't find a way through. And Pickford was looking in one of those moods where he will save most stuff. But even then, Everton, you didn't get the sense they were panicking or worrying. Pickford kept pointing to his head and telling everyone to concentrate. And you thought, it just made you think, wow, they're a team of leaders. And how amazing to be able to cope with a game of two halves so well. So they took advantage of the gaps available when there were gaps. And then when there were not, for a lot of the second half, they were able to absorb the pressure and not panic. Like I say, they just look like, well, this is a phase of the game we can handle. And then on the break. They were devastating and cocky and cheeky. It was, I don't know who they were. But if that's all you saw of Everton all season, you would think, I think I'll tip them for the title.
Gary Jacobs' report in the Times this morning described it as bewildering, which I think, having listened to your very accurate description, Alison, that to me sums it up as well. I was thinking about this game, and we're going to come on to talk about Leicester and Fulham as well. But it's this strange thing that I also think has factored into this relegation battle this season, where you have teams like Brighton who just dip when they play a team near the bottom at the wrong moment for them, but at the perfect moment for Everton, and Everton then get this huge win. But then if you think about, you can't just summarise it as, oh, well, it's the team that they've got nothing left to play for, because you could say the same about Fulham, who, of course, turned it on, having been poor of late against Leicester. Leicester probably thought that, you know, we're going to Craven Cottage. They've kind of sacked it off a little bit. They've been struggling of late. This is a chance here. They get completely rolled over. So it was that perfect cocktail of all those things coming into it. It did make me go back, though, to, we were discussing it on Thursday's show, that 2-2 draw with Leicester that Everton got, which I thought they played well in that. They showed more attacking intensity. They showed that they were like more on the front foot. They were creating chances. I can't remember exactly the stat, but Gregor pointed out that they created at least in the teens number of chances, which they haven't done barely all season. And then you had the Pickford save, and it just felt a little bit like this is the little wind of momentum. Whether or not they'll keep it going, who knows with this season. They'll lose the next match 3-0. But it was all of those things, that cocktail, that led to a kind of bewildering match, as Gary Jacobs said.
Yeah, I don't think they're putting much pressure on the next match because it's against Manchester City. But
listen, Sean, if one man can do it, it's Sean Dyche. He did it against an in-form Arsenal team early in the season, didn't he? So yeah. You never know.
They've got Wolves and Bournemouth in their final two games, so I think they will look to those two to be the matches that keep them up. But for me, it was just more about the spirit, determination, particularly away from home. Again, they're a team that kind of we think, you know, at Goodison Park, they're a different animal to the one that goes away from home. To be honest, they've not been great either home or away for quite some time. And it was just, it was a very perverse thing to see in terms of the confidence with which some players played. It was like we'd been transported to another season. It was like, who are you? Where have you come from? Where were you last week or the week before that? Because it wasn't just, it was weird. You know, Dwight McNeil, it was a player from when he burst into the Burnley team at the start of his career. It was a player who was, you know, played with so much freedom.
It was brilliant finishes, like real confidence, as you say. The one where he tiptoed around the goalkeeper when in that situation, in that context, for this match at this point in the season, you wouldn't have been surprised if he'd shanked it wide or blazed it over, tiptoes around the goalkeeper. I think he even had the bollocks to do a celebration before he put it in the net, didn't he? I mean, I was like, this guy, which again fits in with Alison's theory that if you were watching them, you're thinking, oh, these guys are loving it. They've had the best season ever. So excited, celebrating goals before they score them. You're like, mate, chill out. You might get beat next week and you'll be back in the scrap.
It boggled my mind completely, to be honest. I'm sure the Everton fans were in dreamland. I know you mentioned Jordan Pickford, I guess. It's worth remarking on the fact, because a lot of people say, you know, Arsenal have been great this year and Aaron Ramsdale has to be England's number one, that his form has been good to very good to getting great at this point in time. He seems to be improving and strangely enjoying, although not strangely for Jordan Pickford, the situation that they're in, because it brings something out of him as a character, I think, that helps his goalkeeping.
He always struck me as quite a reactionary figure as well. Obviously, in his position, that's an important part of his game. But do you know what I mean? Like, some goalkeepers are composed and they come and claim everything and they look really at ease and calm. Pickford is one of those where he's kind of making sharp saves. He needs that frenzy a little bit, and you obviously get that with a relegation scrap. And he needs those moments. And I, Alison, your point about him kind of pointing to his head and saying, composure, lads. He's almost kind of saying that to everyone else because he's like, I'm loving this. That, you know, you can send, he does that in the most manic and uncomposed moments.
He does, in the most uncomposed
way. You know, people were picking out when he saved the penalty against Leicester, and I think there was still 2-1 down at that point. But he kind of did this little celebration and it was half time. And I was in the office and a lot of people were laughing at him. And I was like, no, he needs that.
Yeah.
And maybe his players feed off that as well a little bit, because I think people forget, like, he's an incredibly experienced player now. Like, he's played a lot of games for England. He's played in big international tournaments. And as you say, he's stepping up in these moments when they really need him.
Can I just say also about Sean Dyche, because we've used words like bewildered and boggled and so on, mm-hmm. but when he was at Burnley, he was very good at thinking of ways to freshen it up, because he was there for a long time, and sometimes they'd be doing surprisingly well in the league, but most of the time they were struggling, and yet he would always somehow get them to respond, and people would suggest maybe, you know, it's time for him to go before he did go because maybe it was a bit stale. But he was very aware of that and would come up with ways of just inspiring them. And so I suspect what's happened is he's seen the spectre of them going down and looking. Let's face it. Everton have looked a bit like they're not going to do it, and yet this has not come out of magic. This has come out of him. Whatever he's been telling them in training, or little things he's been trying, little tricks he's been trying, little motivational speeches, he's done something to really boost their self-esteem and the idea that it's not over. It will be down to him. It's not an accident.
I want to ask whether you think Everton will stay up. Because there is also part of me who wants to revel in them scoring 5 goals and, you know, finishes into the top corner and some players, you know, just playing out of their skin. But it was very much, you know, it was this 90 minutes. It was an episode of Doctor Who. I was in a different universe, let's be honest, compared to some of the football that we've seen from them of late. And it's a huge question mark as to whether they can produce. Like I said, if they produce anywhere near this, they'll get results. They haven't produced anywhere near this for quite some time, really. So can they do it in those final 3 matches? Can they stay in the Premier League?
It's probably down to, we talked about them scoring goals and you highlighted Dwight McNeil. I was looking at this team and I was thinking, this is the most attacking Everton can be, really, whilst also still being with their best players and all the kind of characteristics that a Sean Dyche team wants to be. But actually, all that means is that Dwight McNeil and Dominic Calvert-Lewin are playing, when you talk about being attacking, do you know what I mean? And yes, Doucouré got forward and scored goals, but he again epitomised the kind of, oh, who's this guy? Chelsea will be buying him for 80 million in the summer, won't they, off this one game. So it'll be down to Calvert-Lewin staying fit. Be down to whether McNeil can kind of keep that twinkle-toed confidence going to the end of the season. And you wouldn't be surprised if they didn't. You wouldn't be surprised if this was their one game. And they then, it wouldn't shock me if Everton then lost the next 3, even after this. That's the point about this season. I think, and this comes back to Alisson's point, I think because of Sean Dyche, I don't think it will be a case of them now losing the next 3. I think he will make sure that they take something from this into those 2 games that you highlight, and they could have it just enough to then get over the line.
Brighton have previously been booed off. That was a different team at a different time, who had drawn a match under Graham Potter, and I remember him famously coming out and saying, you know, these fans need a dose of reality, et cetera, not in those exact words, but essentially, you know, we are still Brighton, we've come a long, long way, maybe these fans need a history lesson, something along those lines. Anyway, they were booed off at halftime in this game, and you kind of think, actually, it was absolutely deserved because they have hit such high levels under Roberto De Zerbi. They were so far off it in this game, despite the possession that they had to allow the goals that they did. And you almost feel like, I never really felt like Brighton were good enough, it's not really fair, consistent enough to really trouble the top 6. I think they'll get close to it, but these games and some of the games in which they've dropped points throughout the season had always suggested to me that you couldn't really trust them. Against the big teams, you're like, yeah, Brighton will give them a good go. They'll probably win that game. And then they'll draw with Crystal Palace in a couple of matches, or they'll drop some points against Bournemouth. And we'll also, and this is the main thing. It goes under the radar because Brighton don't get the same publicity as a Manchester United dropping points, or an Arsenal clearly in a title race, or Liverpool or whatever. You know, when Brighton drop points, listen, Brighton lost 5-1 yesterday. You know, had that happened to a team that we'd regularly seen in European football, I think it would be seen in a very different light. So for me, I think there are still weaknesses. Strangely, in games that you'd expect them to win, they kind of draw too many games against the teams in the bottom 7 or 8. And that will cost them.
I think you're being slightly unfair. I think some of the points dropped by Brighton have come in unfortunate circumstances where VAR has not gone their way, and
some.
I think they've had quite a lot of controversial decisions, yeah, more than most. Certainly they've come in games where you've thought, well, they're the better team, how come that happened? Some of the points have been dropped while they've been playing well. I don't think they've had games like this.
Drew with Forest, drew with Leicester, drew with Leeds this season, drew with Brentford this season, lost 3-1 to Nottingham Forest not too long ago, a couple of weeks back.
Yeah, it's not entirely that they dip because the opposition isn't as glamorous. It isn't entirely that, is all I'm saying. But I think most people would have been, if I'd been a Brighton fan, I would never boo my own team, but I might have been a bit miserable because I was there on Thursday night when they beat Manchester United with a 99th minute goal. I mean, the atmosphere was absolutely astonishing because they'd played brilliant, entertaining football. And I can't go through all those points dropped and hand on heart say it, but I'm pretty sure they entertained while they were dropping them. Mm. And if there's a shame to this defeat, it's that it does mean they might not make Europe, and I think they would light up Europe and Europe would not know what to make of them. And it would be fantastic for the world of football if they were to qualify for European competition. So they've had one bad half. They played well in the second half, but it was a bit like their home game against Fulham, where it was complete one-way traffic. They get these periods where they're playing beautiful, but they just can't finish it. But they're still, even in the second half, we're talking about 145 minutes of being drab. Even in this defeat for 45 minutes, they played entertaining football.
Still got five games, but three of them very difficult matches. They go away to Arsenal and Newcastle in their next two. They then host Southampton, host Manchester City, who could be crown champions on that day. So you can imagine the pressure there. And then they go to Aston Villa on the final day. And that still might be an Aston Villa who are also chasing Europe. So it's not really an easy running for Brighton. That's maybe why in my heart of hearts I'm quite disappointed with their defeat. But there you go. A very important 3 points for Everton in this match, who gave their chances of staying up a massive boost. The same too for Nottingham Forest, who came out on top in a 7-goal thriller at the City Ground, climbing out of the bottom three and leaving Southampton on the brink of relegation. It was a fantastic game, finished 4-3. Charlotte Dunker was at the game for The Times, and she joins us now. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi, you all right?
Very well. Firstly, tell us, what was key to the victory?
Anyone that watched that game, it was just so frantic. I think there was some really poor defending from both sides, but I think Nottingham Forest really did show some quality in the way they attacked. We saw them on the counter-attack. Taiwo Awoniyi pulled out two finishes that personally I didn't even know he had in his locker, having watched in this season. So I think it was a bit of that. It was grit and determination from Forest to get over the line as well. And they saw it through, but it was a really tense, nervy finish for them.
Do you think Steve Cooper is finding another gear in this team? Because they have been playing quite well recently. They haven't always got the results. Did you feel that it was going to come against Southampton and there is more to come in the rest of the season?
Yeah, I feel like there was a lot of pressure on them to win last night, especially when you looked at the other results yesterday, with Everton winning, Leicester obviously losing, and given that Southampton are bottom of the table, I think there was sort of an expectancy, given how good Forest's home record is, that they would just go there and beat Southampton. So that is added pressure for a team who are fighting for their lives at the bottom of the table. But I think you're right in terms of they have improved in recent weeks. I thought they've looked better when they've gone to a back three, back five. Maybe if they'd gone to that earlier in the season, they would have picked up more points. And I know they reverted back to a back four last night, but he's just got to find a way to get over the line. I think they've been lucky with some of the points they've dropped recently, because their performances have improved. But they've got three massive games coming up: Chelsea, Arsenal and Crystal Palace. So big 3 points, but they're definitely not over the line yet.
What about Ruben Selles? When you spoke to him afterwards, what kind of figure did he cut? Because it hasn't really worked with him in charge for Southampton. Looks like they are going down to the Championship. And he has to try and find some kind of positivity here, you know, just, you know, to give themselves a fighting chance, or it will all be done in their next match.
Yeah, I think there was a bit of realism from him and acceptance as well, that him and his staff, I know they've only been there since February, and Southampton were at the bottom of the table when they took over, but I think there was a belief that they could come in and turn things around. So him and his team are accepting of what they haven't been able to do, which they haven't been able to get them out of the bottom three. And now going forward, it's what is this team going to look like? Is he going to be the man in permanent charge? His contract's up at the end of the season. He said talks will be going on in the next few weeks when the picture becomes clearer about what's going to happen next season. He said he'd happily stay there for the next 10 years and it's up to the club. So be interesting to see if he's given the time, if he's given the budget and everything else to really put his mark on this team. But he's not been able to do what they hoped because it looks inevitable that they're going to go down.
Charlotte, can I just ask you, because you were there, so I watched it on TV and yeah. I couldn't make up my mind if I was utterly convinced that Southampton were going to get a very late goal to make it a draw and then make everyone stay unhappy. But in the stadium, did it feel possible? Because it felt like there was a brittleness there underlying the Forest performance.
Yeah, especially if you go back the week before, I think it was Brentford, wasn't it? Forest were winning 1-0 and then they conceded 2 in the last 10 minutes to lose. So I think they've definitely got form of throwing these results away. And Southampton just kept peppering the box and McCarthy, the goalkeeper, came up. And I think every Forest fan in the stadium was like holding their breath. And I was watching Steve Cooper and he came into the press conference soaking wet because it was raining with this towel. And I thought he looked like he needed a stiff drink. And I'm not sure how he's going to get through the next 3 games if Forest are going to do that to him. And I don't support Forest or Southampton, but you felt the tension. It was nervous energy from everyone. And given the way that Forest have defended this season and the way they've given away sloppy goals, and especially that Felipe's goal was just offside, that would have made it 5-2. So, 10th end to the game, definitely.
The home form is something that people point to when it comes to Nottingham Forest. What was the atmosphere like? Arsenal are the only team left to come to the City Ground. What kind of prospect will it be?
Yeah, this sounds like a massive cliche, but it genuinely is a brilliant atmosphere. I'd say it's up there with one of the best that they've got in the league. They sing with their flags and their scarves and their banners before kickoff. And one of the things that Steve Cooper always talks about in his press conferences is that even when Forest have been playing poorly or they've gone behind, the fans still have their back. And he says that's really helped the team. So Arsenal are obviously going to go there for Forest's last game of the season. Will the title be mathematically out of their hands by then? Who knows? That could help Forest if Arsenal don't have anything to really play for anymore. But Arsenal are a great outfit, aren't they? I don't think they're going to be intimidated by a raucous atmosphere at the City Ground. But we have seen Forest pick up some big points against big teams this season. So yeah, they're going to hope to go out on a high anyway, the Forest fans at home.
Okay, Charlotte, appreciate you joining us to reflect on the match. Appreciate it. And we'll speak to you soon.
Thank you. Take care.
So, Tom, what did you make of it? Victory for Forest. They got over the line just about in the end. You know, it was a massively crucial 3 points. They had to win this game. And they've still got work to do, but they've given themselves a great chance.
They have. I think it was interesting that Charlotte, the first thing she picked out was the attack, counter-attacking Brennan Johnson, Morgan Gibbs-White and Ione. You know, they played really, really well. I was looking at the stats this morning. It's interesting to me how, with all the changes, all the signings, all the tumultuous changes on and off the pitch at Forest, that Brennan Johnson, obviously I'm going to mention him given his Lincoln connections in the past, but 35 games played for them this season, age 21, more than any other player. 2,830 minutes, that's more than any other player as well. Morgan Gibbs-White is second in both of those rankings for Forest. So it's interesting to me that this player, who a young player, hugely talented, never played in the Premier League, in a squad that's got varying different levels of experience and talent, he's been the real star. And I think he epitomised what they did really well in this game. They were on the front foot, they were pressing really effectively. I think he was involved in all 4 of the goals, or at least 3 of them. And so I think that that gives Forest something to really hold on to in the coming games, that if those front three are firing, which Gibbs White and Brennan Johnson have been for most of the season, that's the most significant thing. And that whether they're playing Arsenal or whether they're playing other teams lower down the table, that'll be the most important thing, I think, for them.
Huge win for Forest. Do you think they'll stay up?
Oh, don't ask questions like that. It's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. Because I don't know, I don't now know what's going to happen at all. I think, yes, okay, they ought to now, because that might be enough. It might just be enough. Maybe they can get a point off Arsenal at home. I don't think that's ridiculous, because it's a different... They play completely differently at home. Yeah. It's not just that they have the support. They play differently. And it's significant to me that, I mean, Charlotte described it beautifully, that the way the fans are there, so you know it's already one of the, you know, the top grounds for an atmosphere, and still the Forest players, when they get close to the crowd, they urge them on. They want even more of it, which proves that it's helping them be better and be braver. And there is that element of daring do about them, which you don't normally get from a team that's struggling at the bottom. So there are enough ingredients there to say, yes, they'll do it, but it's a bit mad at the moment.
I do think the Arsenal game is, you know, it's almost like, I know there are three games left, but it almost feels like Forest have one game left.
Yes.
Such is the difference in the home form. And they can beat anyone at home. We've seen that over the last couple of seasons. So, look, Arsenal, the way they've played recently, you'd have to make them firm favourites. But you never know. And it's been a crazy season. And it could get even crazier. But I also look to the Palace game, even though it's away from home on the final day. And obviously Chelsea haven't been great. But I think Palace may be in party mode on the final day of the season, and that would represent a big opportunity. I wonder if Roy Hodgson's a kind of manager as well to kind of leave everyone out and play some of the players in the squad and give them a game, you know, to say thank you and fond farewell, etc., etc. So I do think there's a very strong chance that Nottingham Forest will stay up. There's absolutely no chance that Southampton are staying up. And I know that next Monday we're probably going to be talking about it being done for them, and it isn't yet done for them. So I don't want to go too deep on it. And we'll probably go into all of the reasons why, the deeper reasons why Southampton will get relegated. But just in a footballing terms, and in this game in particular, why do you think they weren't at the level they needed to be?
Goodness me. How far am I allowed to go back? I think if you think about that squad, we talked a lot. You know, I just mentioned their Forest's attacking trio being on song. And you think about some of the other teams that might stay up, whether they've got an experienced manager, whether they've got major changes that have worked. Southampton, it's a combination and a culmination of lots of different aspects on and off the pitch that have left them kind of with a complete vacuum, really. There's nothing there that is the thing that is going to keep them up, to me. They made managerial changes that didn't work. Nathan Jones, obviously, the most spectacular of those. The player-wise, it's a lot to ask. I think James Ward-Prowse is a wonderful player, but he's not quite, I don't think, the superstar level of a player that can kind of keep a team up on his own. And then all around him is a lot of inexperience, a lot of youth, a lot of talented young players, but it's just not enough. So that is where it's slightly unravelled for them. And also, you know, we talked then about Forest, about them having the thing of being brilliant at home. I don't know what necessarily Southampton's thing has been in terms of performance. They've briefly, and a little bit under Ruben Sellers, they made big performances away from home against big teams, their thing. But then they didn't necessarily get the points, for example, in that Arsenal game. They were leading and ended up drawing the game. So they never really had this is what Southampton have got that could keep them up, other than James Ward-Prowse being superb at set pieces. So that to me is probably a very rounded answer, not a specific, but there we go. That's what I was thinking when you asked me.
So it looks like Southampton are going to be relegated, and the only question is really who will join them. Of course, we spoke a little bit earlier on about Everton, Leicester's survival hopes suffering a blow. This was a 5-3 defeat at Fulham. The Foxes into the relegation zone. They're 2 points from safety with three games remaining, and they have a tough run in. They're at home to Liverpool next, away at Newcastle. They then host West Ham on the final day. For me, if they do go down, I've got to say, the draws with Leeds and Everton in the past two games will be what cost them. I know Leicester fans will say there were some incredibly good chances against them in those matches, which meant the result could have gone the other way. But equally, I think Leicester had enough chances in the match that they could have absorbed those and still won the game. Defensively, though, in this match, they were not good enough. And it made me really reflect on selling Wesley Fofana and whether that was worth the money that they've brought in, because they bought in Wout Faes and he's an unproven player in the Premier League. He also cost about £15 million. So you replaced your £80 million centre-half with a £15 million centre-back. The likes of Soyuncu, you know, drafted back into the team under Dean Smith, who hadn't been deemed good enough before, and the investment in Yannick Vestergaard, even though it was a squad player, shows you that in that area, they haven't had enough. Daniel Amati playing centre-back in the Premier League for far too long. Gregor's bugbear, obviously, as you all know. But it's that area of the pitch, I think, that will cost them. I know the midfield has had issues. Some players, some want-away players, some had their heads turned by big bids. There just hasn't been that cohesion. But every time you see the squad in general, you think there are more than enough good players for Leicester to not be in this situation, even if their defence wasn't great this year. Ultimately, I guess a bit like Southampton, we may well end the season reflecting on kind of half a dozen major issues that have led to this point. They're not yet down, so I don't want to be too glum about them, but they were awful in this game. And actually, the scoreline's quite flattering.
I was at Craven Cottage, and it was utterly bizarre. Fulham players' legs functioned better than the Leicester players' legs. It was everything. They looked like they'd had a proper service and they'd been oiled and they were running properly. And Leicester's legs looked like they were made of wood or metal and were rusting and it creaking. It was really strange. And there was, I think, Tom, you said something about Fulham being on the beach or having something not much to play for. Actually, Fulham have quite a lot to play for. They would like to finish above Chelsea this season. That means a hell of a lot. In fact, all the chants were aimed at John Terry in the dugout by the Fulham fans. So it definitely does matter that they are doing better than Chelsea this season. But they certainly had that sense of freedom. They really enjoyed their football, had a great time, and Leicester just did not know what to do. Their shape was appalling. Their body language was appalling. As I said, they didn't look like they knew how to run, actually make their legs function anymore. Ridiculously one-sided game. They did get into it more because Fulham kept insisting on little flicks and tricks and being a bit self-indulgent and not concentrating enough themselves. Which all makes for a very thrilling game. But significantly, away from the entertainment, afterwards, Dean Smith said he didn't see it coming. That on the training ground, he sees a team that are very good and very talented. And he's been telling them how talented they are. I suspect he needs to change his message, because when every time a goal went in, you looked at the Leicester players and they all had that look about them where they're like, well, it's not down to me, is it? I'm surrounded by idiots. So it's, if you're telling players they're really good, they haven't got that glue which binds them together, that they've got something to fight for. James Maddison said afterwards, we lacked hunger. Is that because you've been told how good you are and that this was going to be a relatively simple game where you could outshine silly little Fulham? That they don't look cohesive. They don't even look like they truly know they're in a relegation battle. And if they do know, then what it's doing to them is paralysing them rather than inspiring them. So there's a hell of a lot of work to do in psychological terms too, because you're not going to make those defenders you've outlined, Hugh, better. But what you can do is give them a sense of, well, hunger and fight and just accept they're in, but their running is so difficult. So that even though their goal difference would speak of a team that's surely too good to go down, I think they will.
I do think that in a way, the difficulty of the matches to come makes it easier tactically. Do you know what I mean?
Well, there is a point with these fixtures, as reeling off these fixtures, and I made all my notes and went through and picked out all the fixtures they've got to come, and then actually I'm thinking about it, sat here, and you're talking about Everton smashing Brighton and things like that, and you're like, it doesn't matter who anyone's playing. It's all out the window. I'm saying Fulham are on the beach, Alisson's saying they're brilliant. All those things can be true. It's all nonsense. Who the hell knows? We shouldn't even look at the fixtures.
No, but you know what I mean? If you're Dean Smith, you're like, right, this is the plan for three very tough games. We're going to play on the counter-attack. We're going to keep it tight. We're going to play narrow. You know, we basically can't make any mistakes. So if you get the ball, Valfez, put it in Rose Edge.
Yeah,
you know,
I see what you mean, yeah.
In terms of your approach to the games, that's it. You know, you play on the counter-attack. You try and keep tight. And you tell the players that basically you need to fight for your lives because we are in a relegation battle. We are about to go down. And I don't mind if we literally claw out the eyes of the opposition and win three games 1-0 or even draw three games 1-1. You know, it's something that we need to do to stay in the Premier League because we can't think, oh, if we go out and play to our best, we'll win this game. Because actually that's not going to happen. You see what I mean? In terms
you're
of,
agreeing with me, I think.
Yeah, I'm agreeing with you. In terms of when I say playing to our best, obviously if you play to your best, you win games, not like that. To play the way that we want, the style that we want, what's brought us success over the last few years and won us an FA Cup, or James Maddison, if you just take yourself back to that player that was stringing through beautiful passes, and Harvey Barnes, if you just keep running at people and using your speed and some dribbling ability, I don't want to see any of that. I want to see, keep it tight, I want to see eight players basically sit behind the ball, and I want two of you up there who basically, we will long it to you and you chase it down. Jamie Vardy, if Iheanacho comes back from injury, you know, whoever you've got, Harvey Barnes, you know, that's the game plan.
But has he been undermined? Because before this game, Dean Smith pointed out the fact that they'd gone 19 games without a clean sheet, which is a European record. So post-World Cup, that they're the team that cannot keep a clean sheet. And he said the secret, I'm amazed he said this really, he said the secret to staying up is keeping a clean sheet. And after he says this, they let in 5 goals at Craven Cottage. So that there's now a huge gulf between, so it's now 20 games on the trot, and to go from conceding 5 goals, and it could have been more, to suddenly making a clean sheet thing you need. Well, clearly that's not going to work. They're not going to keep a clean sheet, are they? They're going to have to somehow find a way of crystallising what happened at Craven Cottage, but making sure they just switch on sooner and, as you say, Hugh, fight a bit more and be a bit more basic about it. Because they were incredibly passive, and I've seen them be passive most of the season, and I put it down to Brendan Rodgers sort of knowing that his time was going to be up at some point, so he wasn't giving it that project idea that everyone was just sort of floating around wondering what was going to happen next season and thinking of themselves and not the club, manager included. But now they've got a proper target, which is to somehow fight for survival. But there was no... It's very strange. Given the connection between the players and the fans at Leicester and the fairy tale they've been through, it just seems rather odd that they haven't got that in them to keep that history going.
We talk about conceding chances as well, and you prompted me to look up the stat that I kind of incorrectly quoted earlier. Everton had 23 chances, and as Gregor was saying on the previous show, in that 2-2 draw, when the hell have Everton ever had 23 shots this season? And then they go and score a load of goals in the next game. It's like Leicester, the perfect prep to try and work out how your attacking play can go. Alisson, I wanted to ask about, because in that Thursday show last week, we were talking about Vardy and that idea that maybe he could be the trump card. He's looked dangerous against Everton. Charlotte Dunker wrote a piece last week as well, talking about the fact that he's still there. He's still, in some senses, their talisman, particularly now there's no Kasper Schmeichel. Did he embody all the things you've talked about, the kind of wooden leggedness, the kind of slightly lost performance?
No, that was mainly midfield and defence. He's still Jamie Vardy. He was still, you know, he was whispering to the referee at the start, you know, because the game was delayed by 3 minutes because of some sort of technical issue with the pack they wear on their arms. And, you know, who's going to have a little word with the referee about it? It's going to be Jamie Vardy, you know. What's he saying? He's saying something. He's just reminding people he's around, you know. And he was like that all game. You could see he was talking to people and he was nudging people and making runs. And he did look like it mattered to him. I mean, he missed a penalty. That doesn't mean that might mean he cared too much if you miss a penalty. I'm not saying that might mean he doesn't care. But he, I mean, it's sad to say, but he is a faded version of the Jamie Vardy we all admired enormously. I think he's giving it his all, but he just doesn't have as much to give.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think about the thing I was talking about with Southampton and the idea of what have they got? What is the trump card that could keep them up? And you look at the teams in the bottom three at the minute and you think these are and Leicester are probably the only ones of those three that have got a trump card, but it's an aging Jamie Vardy, or a James Maddison who seems to play one brilliant game and then one awful game. So they're the things where you start to wonder, would I take Jordan Pickford and Dominic Calvert-Lewin and Dwight McNeil and a well-drilled Everton team, or would I take this Leicester team who are a bit wishy-washy and I've got some fading stars or a couple of players who are thinking, I wonder whether I fancy Newcastle or Man United next season. You know, which one would I rather have? I'd probably rather have Everton.
It's going to be an awful week for Leicester. Just doing shape, just doing distances, just doing shadow play. They're probably not going to see a ball for the rest of the week, to be perfectly honest, because it's just going to be all about keeping our spaces and making sure we're tight and defending properly, because after conceding five...
It's a big week for John Terry, that's for sure. And his coaching credentials. Because, yeah, I mean, if they can do it, then they've got former England captain and Chelsea legend. Like, he's in the coaching team. Can Presumably, sign, that's what he's there
as
for.
As a free transfer, can he sign a little short-term deal?
Oh, goodness me, don't tempt him.
I don't know.
All the jokes about the kit would be too much to take.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right, okay, let's continue our conversation about the Premier League, but go to the top of the table next. Arsenal. Reducing Manchester City's lead at the Premier League summit back to 1 point. They came out on top in a great game at Newcastle United. Arteta's side have played one game more than City, but I think responded very, very well to the pressure that City had put on by beating Leeds the day before. I think a lot of people basically had seen Arsenal's trip to Newcastle as a massive hurdle, and this is one that they leapt over, flew over. And it's weird. I watched this game and thought this is exactly what I thought was going to happen after the Manchester City game. And it is everything that we've spoken about in terms of the pressure of the City game maybe affecting the Arsenal players. Because in the game since, I went to the Chelsea game and I thought Arsenal were brilliant, clearly, to go 3-0 up very early. But also they were brilliant in this game at Newcastle United as well. And some of the football was absolutely sensational. And maybe the pressure has come off them, and maybe they prefer being chasers in this title race. Maybe that will help them stay with City, if you like, you know, if they need to win every game and then hope that City in the extra games that they have can drop the ball. Because at the moment, you kind of think Arsenal aren't going to be beaten. You also think Manchester City aren't going to be beaten, but City clearly have more on their plate.
Yeah, it's definitely been a good response to that City defeat. I think if the analogy is them hurdling, then they definitely nicked the hurdle on the way through, didn't they? Yeah. A little bit. They left it dangling and then it stayed upright. Thank God for that. Because Newcastle were brilliant as well. I thought they put in the performance that their recent form suggests. I think when you talk about Arsenal coming through these games, players like Jorginho, incredible experience. It's interesting that Arteta's put him in over Thomas Partey, who's been such a big part of their season in the early parts of the campaign. Martin Odegaard as well, I think, has kind of stepped up since that City game. A few people, Gregor included, kind of quite rightly saying, OK, that's the next thing to add to your game. Huge performances in big games against big teams. He was superb against Newcastle, obviously brilliant against Chelsea as well, and getting goals. So I think they're two big factors that both experienced players who've done it elsewhere are having a say, and then, you know, your kind of captain talisman figure of this young group, the guy that kind of embodies it the most, is stepping up, which is impressive, because I as listeners know, I'm a big fan of Mikel Arteta and what he's done with Arsenal this season, but there is also a little bit of an element of where it does look tired at times. There was a moment, I think in the first half, where Bukayo Saka had the ball on the right, Ben White overlapped, and the way Saka fainted inside onto his left, there was just a slight lethargy about it, like, how many times have I done this? So many times. Like, right, I've fainted onto the left, right, what am I going to do? Whip it in the top corner or nick it to the back post? Ben, oh, I've missed you, sorry. You know, and that's nothing on Saka, but they've just played with such relentless intensity all season that it does feel a little bit like they're playing in moments, Arsenal, rather than complete performances. Moments like Odegaard, moments like Jorginho stepping up and dictating the play for 10 minutes. But don't get me wrong, they're still brilliant, but I wonder whether they're going to have enough to keep going, to keep City honest to all the way to the end of the season now.
Well, I think they have. I think they've come through. It's like childbirth, you know, you've come through.
You'll have to tell us.
There's a moment where you think, this is impossible. And then a miracle happens and all things seem possible. And I look at Arsenal and see them like that. The reason this was such an impressive performance was, first of all, it was at St. James's Park, which is a horrible place to go. It's a horrible place to watch football, actually, because of the light on the shadows on the pitch. I don't like it at all. And but they managed to combine elegant football, occasionally beautiful football and incisive football, with a lot of time wasting and niggling and just annoying everybody and giving back what Newcastle give out all the time. I mean, I think Newcastle are very good at time wasting and moaning and being in the ear of the fourth official and just generally being the most irritating team in the universe. But Arsenal did it to them, and Newcastle did not like it one bit. And also, Newcastle were very good for the first opening 8-9 minutes, and you did think, oh my goodness, you know, this could be the end of the title race completely. Could Arsenal crumble? The fact that they didn't, the fact that they took a deep breath and absorbed that early pressure and then managed to impose their style on the game in sections, not all the way through, it was really grown up, and it felt like my hairdresser's an Arsenal fan. And he says to me, even if Arsenal win the title, he's not going to be overjoyed, because he says, I know we're not the best team in the land. And that's partly because City have outclassed them more than once. So he thinks, well, the best team is City.
Can we get him on? He must be the only pragmatic Arsenal fan in the country, isn't he? That's an outrageous comment. Good on him. But
well, that's how he feels. I can understand him feeling like that. And it makes you wonder about, well, it makes you wonder, doesn't it? Because if Arsenal were to actually get the title because City were distracted by their own beauty because of the Champions League, and are Arsenal really the best team in the land? And it makes you think. But I think that there's a freedom to them having failed their tests against Manchester City. And they now think, well, that was as bad as it's going to get. They are the best team. Maybe they deep down all know City are the best team. And the only way they're going to take the title is with a bit of luck, but with just putting every effort into every game left. And I felt that that's exactly what they did against Newcastle, and good on them. I don't now expect them to suffer a blip. It's all about whether City do.
I tend to agree, but I did say after the City game, if Arsenal win all five games, I think they'll win the title.
Because yeah, I think there's a pep dip coming. You can see it. He's calling it Everton. He's going to play back three.
It's the rotation. I do think a rotation and a bit of injury and a bit of fatigue, and the pressure will be on Manchester City. And, you know, drawing a couple of games is in there. I just think Arsenal now, it's not just about winning the last three games. They're going to have to score a lot of goals as well and hope that it comes down to goal difference and maybe they can pit Manchester City in that area.
The other thing, just going back to Alisson's excellent point, is that and her hairdresser's excellent point, is that if Arsenal, and Tom Allnutt made this point on Thursday's show, if they can kind of finish strongly and finish second with wins like this of this nature against a really strong Newcastle side away from home, then you can, and if then you can say the only reason we didn't win the title was that we were beaten twice by Manchester City, that means your season is a significant elevation from last year. They can go into the summer being like, right, the next target is that we win those games against City and we win the title. That it changes the narrative. That's my favourite word on the podcast. Mm. But it makes it still a brilliant season where they were finished second. They were everyone's favourite team. They gave us a title race that we wouldn't have had otherwise. And they just fell short of an amazing title because they weren't quite as good as Manchester City.
That's going to happen.
Brighton are everybody's favourite second team. Come on.
Well, true. And as long as they finish the season strongly, that's all I'm saying. You know, these things can change quickly.
It was interesting. Great stat. Martinelli and Ødegaard both scored 15 goals in the Premier League this season. That's the first time that Arsenal have had two players score 15 or more goals in a Premier League season, which I find incredible. Given the forward players, the attacking players that have played for Arsenal down the years. But there you go. Very good season from both of them. I hate to say it, Ødegaard is my player of the year.
He's mine too.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see if Haaland gets it. But, you know, especially...
Haaland will get it. But I voted for Ødegaard because he's more interesting to watch.
Is that, are you allowed to say that you voted for him?
It's not a private vote. I can say what I want.
All right. let's move swiftly on. Very good win for Arsenal. Manchester United are in a massive dip. Howler from David De Gea, gifting West Ham victory. Massive victory for West Ham, boosting their Premier League survival hopes. But the defeat will hurt Manchester United's top four chances. David Moyes' side are 7 points clear of the relegation zone and they have a much better goal difference to the sides below them. Manchester United just a point ahead of Liverpool in fifth. They beat Brentford, although United do have a game in hand. But it is worth asking the question, what is going wrong for Manchester United? Because it is turning into a disastrous end to the season. Only 4 wins in their last 10 Premier League matches. Interesting stat as well. United have only picked up 1 point in their 8 away games against the sides currently 9th and above in the Premier League. That is the joint fewest of any side with those fixtures. Same as Nottingham Forest. And obviously we know how bad their away record has been. So maybe I've got the answer to what's going wrong for Manchester United. Part of me wants to do what I always do.
And
criticise the squad. But actually, I wanted to ask you all whether there are question marks over what Erik ten Hag has been doing, because it has been easy for several years, if not longer, to blame the players at Manchester United. And I do think there's a lack of quality that's been shown in the last 10 matches with some injuries that Manchester United have had, most notably the two first-choice centre-halves, Varane and Martinez, getting injured. But I think Casemiro getting his ban, Eriksen being injured, it meant that kind of the spine of the team was severely disrupted. But ultimately, they are subpar, Manchester United, at this point in time. I think they've scored 3 goals in the last 6 games in all competitions. So, you know, it's clearly a pattern that they're just underperforming at the moment.
Yeah, and I think you're right to pick out Ten Hag. I remember talking after the cup final win against Newcastle and describing that moment as like a checkpoint in his Manchester United time, that whatever happens this season, they can go back to that. He's won a trophy. That's a huge moment. But I mean, if they don't get in the top four, I would argue that that checkpoint is null and void. It'd be almost completely pointless, because it'd be such a disaster. And I mentioned there about Arsenal and narrative. If the narrative of United season becomes that it unravels completely and they finish fifth, that would be pretty awful in terms of where they were. A lot of people thought, oh, they've got third sewn up. Yeah, we're going to beat City in the final, win 2 domestic cups. No chance. I think it's interesting that you pick out Casemiro, Martinez, and you know that kind of idea of a spine of the team, and then you highlight goals, because ultimately that then comes down to Marcus Rashford. They've really only had, to me, 4-5 exceptional players this season, and that those 5 players have carried them. Casemiro, Martinez, Luke Shaw, Rashford, maybe Eriksen, maybe Fernandes, a combination of the two whenever they've both been fit. That is ultimately where they're at. Is that then Ten Hag's fault for not coming up with other ways of playing with other players? You know, Paul Hurst, he must have written Anthony Martial, can he be the answer, about 53 times in his time as a Manchester correspondent for The Times. But that is what he's dealing with. You know, there's a news story in The Times this morning about Wout Weghorst maybe getting another deal as a backup striker. You know, he works very hard. He's a lovable guy. He's one of my favourite additions to a top six team ever. But he's not. He's part of that reason they're not scoring goals, because he's your main talisman and main striker. So I don't know whether it is Ten Hag's fault, but you've got to say he's known this was the situation. You'd imagine there was a different plan, or at least some kind of alternate plan, because he's relied a lot on a core group of players who I think have just run out of steam.
I don't like the way United cope with away games at all. I don't like their attitude to them. It's as though they're too posh to accept that things can happen in an atmosphere, and that the team they're playing against will lift their game for the arrival of Manchester United. I think Ten Hag tries to keep them steady and level. He's a very level person. He was asked about the importance of the West Ham game ahead of it, and that it could be a critical one in terms of securing their top four place. And he said the right words, which were, it is absolutely essential for a club of Manchester United's stature to finish in the Champions League places. But there was no, the way he is, there was no passion in that. It was like he was reading a spreadsheet and he was an accountant. It was almost like, well, we are good, and our brilliance will come out regardless of where we're playing. Sometimes you have to accept what's happening in the stadium you're visiting and what it means to them. So the players often look slightly flummoxed or petulant about it, that the mood of the place is lifting those around them, then they hadn't trained for it to be like that. It's almost like, when are you going to learn that an away game requires a different skill set?
Manchester United lack passion away from home. I do think that kind of mirrors the demeanour of the manager, I've got to say. They've kind of injected someone who is very tactical, who has a blackboard and a piece of chalk at the front of the classroom, and who's ready to come up with a solution. But ultimately, he doesn't inject passion into the room. It's not the School of Rock, let's put it that way, when Erik ten Hag is in charge. And I do think Manchester United are kind of like, we basically think they'll show up to games away from home. Again, I don't want to go into a massive rant criticising them, but I do think Erik ten Hag needs to find a solution with the players that he's got. Because at this point in time, I know a lot of the reaction to the result was to blame the Glazers, blame the ownership group once again. It's their fault that this is going on. We should have more depth in the squad. There should be more quality in all of these things going back and back. But I think Manchester United have enough to score a goal at West Ham. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, had they lost 5-0, you know, we might be talking about bigger things, but Manchester United are just a little bit off it. I do think they're running out of steam, but ultimately they're also not playing well. Running out of steam was on the manager, in my opinion, because there have been times where Manchester United needed to rotate more than they did. When a lot of the players who were out at the moment were fit, he felt they need a little bit of a rest, you know, leave him out one game in six, bring in a Victor Lindelof while all of your best players are there, so he's got support around him. It was all or nothing. All of the best players on the pitch, Manchester United can get results. When all the best players are off the pitch, obviously they can't, and we've known that from seasons gone by. But I think one of the other reactions is obviously to think about the summer. You have big-name Manchester United ex-players talking about the lack of direction over who's going to be taking over the club. Clearly is stunting the ability to recruit well and get, you know, their ducks in a row in terms of the summer. And again, I do think those inside the club, you know, there's always money at Manchester United. Even the Glazers have spent, what, I think it's 10% less than Manchester City over the last 6 years. I mean, it's, you know, it's £1 billion, basically. They've always spent plenty of money. They've spent plenty of money badly. The question is, those at the club, who I imagine will still be the people in charge if there's a new owner in the short term, they still have to make the same decisions for the summer. They're still going to be looking at the same players. The question about whether they can get them or not is really the only difference. So in that regard, I think it's kind of an excuse for the manager once again. And I like Erik ten Hag, But ultimately,
you're starting to turn, is what you're saying.
No, not at all. I'm seeing a good manager with some good players. You know, when Liverpool are hurtling up behind you, and they have apparently had such a torrid season, you know, I start to think, what's the difference between them and us? Yeah, they've got a Mo Salah, they've got a couple of world-class players, a Van Dijk on their day, I get that. But Manchester United have a lot, again, they have a lot of good players, you can make excuses for them, there are very good players in the Manchester United squad, but Liverpool have Jurgen Klopp, ultimately.
Mm.
You know.
Who's going to finish fourth then? We've got a fan from each. Hugh, who's fourth? United?
Liverpool.
He says, looking at Alison Rudd across the studio. Alison, who's fourth?
I feel out of politeness.
You have
I should
say
United.
United
and then we walk into the sunset together. But no, I am now envisaging Alison winning a header against Southampton in the 92nd minute. And it's being Liverpool.
Yeah, I mean, look.
There you go.
Though for me, look, the fixtures are kind to Manchester United in all seriousness.
Fixtures don't matter. We've been through this.
But in terms of the home form, they do. Because Manchester United have three home games basically left. And if they win those games, they will be in the Champions League. They'll finish above Liverpool. So do I think they'll win the home games? Yes. Do I think they'll play well? No. So I think it will still be seen as a drab end to the season where Manchester United limp over the line and finish, I imagine, a point above Liverpool. And that will be seen as a success. They'll probably lose 4-1 in the cup final after that, and then it will be negative headlines a week later. So
you've changed your prediction?
If you're asking me, my prediction was based on who's the better team right now. The reason I said Liverpool was, in my heart of hearts, who's going to finish the season better from here on out? Liverpool are.
You did a quick bit of maths and you were like, no.
Will it be enough to close the gap? No, I think they'll finish a point behind us. That's my prediction. Man United win their games at home. But it will not shock me if we don't and Liverpool finish above us, basically. I also don't think Liverpool have been as good as their 6 wins in a row suggest.
No, they haven't. That's true.
So we'll see. Was that me sitting on the fence by giving both answers? I think
it was. Gregor's not on though, so we needed you.
Right, before we go, you mentioned the man himself, Gregor Robertson. He joins us on the line because there is something special for Gregor Robertson to discuss. He's basically hit the high point of his illustrious career. He's gone even higher than those great games he played for the likes of Grimsby and Nottingham Forest because he has covered the 92 grounds of the English Football League and Premier League as well. They've all been ticked off. He did it this weekend at Bristol Rovers. But Gregor, it was all by accident, wasn't it?
That was the overriding feeling, yeah. I thought, how on earth did it come to this? I mean, growing up in Scotland, I'd never heard of half of these places, and then like for the first half of my life, and then the second half of my life, I just found myself sitting at the Mem, thinking I was plotting a lot of the second half of my life through visits as a player or as a writer to these grounds, but I've loved it as well.
Tell us about the final game. What were the emotions?
It was a good place to end, I think, because the Mem is like the home of Bristol Rovers is kind of sums up how restless the 92 is, in that it's only been Bristol Rovers home for 27 years. The one before that, which is the longest of I think 8 homes altogether, burned down in a fire, and they're also got plans to move to another home in the east of the city in the years ahead. So, like, doing the 92 is no mean feat. And as some people have said to me after reading this piece, you know, it costs a lot of money, it takes a lot of years, and I don't think I've paid for one ticket. So, you know, Scotsman, I'm also quite happy about that. But have you paid
for your tie and lapel pin?
I've not yet. I've got to actually...
Oh, that is so stingy.
I mean, no, because I've got to. The rules state that I have to fill out every game in alphabetical order, so not like chronologically, in alphabetical order of you know, the clubs in the 92, and a date and a time. I think even a score. So that's also no mean feat itself.
Christ,
so,
knowing how long it takes you to file your copy, you're going to be doing that for weeks.
Yeah, fair point. No, so I'm sure we'll get around to that, and I'll bring in the tie and the lapel to show you guys.
It's absolutely lovely.
It is.
Can you listen? It's a weird one because some of the games you played in, some of the games you watched. Which was your favourite ground?
Do you know, to play, when people ask me that, I always say Kenilworth Road, and like people laugh because it's like a you know, it's ramshackle, you know, corrugated iron patched together, the famous you know, archway between a terrace house that, you know, and then you're going up steps to look in someone's back garden as you get into one of the stands. It's a dump, but I absolutely loved playing there because the stands were so tight to the pitch. It felt like a real proper old ground. It was tight. The fans were right on top of you. Great atmosphere. Same was true of Fratton Park, Pompey, home of Portsmouth. Mm. So I liked those tight grounds, those tight old grounds. Accrington Stanley less so because you could hear the individual cries from the few hundred fans there, and they weren't always very kind. So those as a player, I liked the old grounds like that. And as a journalist, as I said in the piece, Bloomfield Road stood out because of the remarkable ups and downs in my time as a journalist that Blackpool have endured. And you see kind of how important supporters are, actually. You know, I've seen, obviously after retiring, I suddenly saw football through supporters' eyes when you saw the Hardy fans boycotting for the fourth year outside their own club as just before a plum FA Cup tie against Arsenal. That was like the saddest thing I've ever seen. And then a few months later, when Owen Oyston was finally gone, their much maligned owner, the crowd, as they scored a 96th minute equaliser, spilling onto the pitch, many of them in tears, was probably the happiest thing I've ever seen inside a football ground. So that they stand out, but there are many, many, obviously. As I said in the piece, there's like an associated memory with just about every single ground in the 92. So it's been quite a journey.
Gregor, appreciate your memories. Thank you for joining us. I know he's celebrating a Scottish Premiership victory for Celtic today as well. So thanks for giving up your time and joining us on the Game Podcast. And that is it for today's episode of the Game Podcast. So, Alison Rudd, Tom Clark, thank you very much for being great company once again. Thank you all for listening. It's Tuesday, so slightly different. We'll be back very, very soon reacting to the semi-finals in the Champions League. Manchester City taking on Real Madrid tonight. We'll have an all-Italian affair, AC Milan against Inter Milan as well. Big, big derby match there. And, of course, another big weekend of Premier League football to look ahead to. But make sure you check out all of our great articles reacting to the weekend and, of course, looking ahead to City's big semi in the game right now. You can also check it out online, thetimes.co.uk/thegame. Pick up a paper, as always. You can download the Times app wherever you get your apps from as well. We'll be back with you on Thursday. We'll see you then.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.